In the book of Daniel, we have a discussion of this fierce figure that was a scourge to Israel. And it was such a perfect statement of the events that took place with Antiochus Epiphanes IV back in about 198 B.C. It was such a precise statement about it that rabbis were saying, the rabbis themselves were saying it couldn't be prophecy, it had to be history, that Daniel had to have been written after the events of Antiochus Epiphanes. But the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls have placed the book of Daniel at a time that was prior to the coming of this figure, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, probably that name doesn't mean a whole lot to you, but he was a real scourge of Israel. One of the Ptolemies, actually from Egypt, and overran Israel about 198 B.C., and he ran pigs through the temple. He destroyed the temple and then ran pigs through the altar, which, of course, is a great abomination to the Jewish people because pigs were the symbol of all that was corrupt, and they were forbidden to eat it. Today, the Orthodox people won't touch pork. Now, that may be more helpful for them not to eat pork, but at any rate, it was a great desecration to their altar. Now, thereby hangs a tale. No, that was back in 198 B.C. The time factor of this chapter is given to us precisely. There's no need for people to be in any confusion about when all of these events are going to take place. Because Jesus says to them, and this is in about verse 15, the disciples have asked him, when is this going to take place? And Jesus said, when you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which in Judea flee to the mountains, etc. So the time factor is identified or nailed down by this reference to the passage in Daniel and to the abomination of desolation, which was the event where the pigs were run through the temple. Now, what has to happen then? You have to have a temple. And you have to have some kind of desecration of that temple to complete this prophecy. At the present time, you certainly don't have a temple in Jerusalem other than the Mohammedan mosque, the Muslim mosque, on the Temple Mount. A Temple Mount is a large plateau at the southeast corner of Jerusalem. And it's where the original temple stood, which was torn down, and now the Muslim mosque stands in that point. And the interesting thing is that almost any picture of Jerusalem that identifies it has this Muslim mosque in it, because it has this great brilliant gold dome that sticks up above the temple walls. And when you sit in the hotel across the way on the Mount of Olives, as I did many times, and studied the scene, a lot of my understanding of things now relates to the time I spent in the hotel looking out across the valley to Jerusalem, and that you could see the whole walled city at one sweep. And the Mosque of Omar with the gold dome predominant in your view of the area. All right, so now we have to have a temple. Apparently, you can spiritualize it and just leave yourself in complete confusion. But if you take it for what it says, then you find in Ezekiel 44 to 44 to 48, that a temple is constructed in Jerusalem. And once again, you've got four chapters there that people have tried to spiritualize to get around any direct statement about the building of a temple, but it's there. And it's not the temple of Herod. There are differences in the description of that temple versus the temple of Herod, which was, of course, the one that Jesus was talking about in this 24th chapter. That is the one that the disciples were commenting on, and Jesus says, not one stone will be left above upon another. So the impact of chapters 44 to 48 in Ezekiel, to read those, often helps to read the scripture if you want to understand prophecy, although most people read books about it. But there the description is that you have this temple, and then you have a great river of water coming out from under the altar. And the Temple Mount is so located that that would go right down into the Kidron Valley and down into the Valley of Judea, and which winds right down to the Dead Sea. And the description is that the waters of this temple coming out from under the altar are going to sweeten the waters of the Dead Sea. And you're going to have trees lining that valley of Judea, which is at the present time a dry, dusty road. I don't think there's any more arid or barren roadway in the country than that road down through the Judean Valley. And my room at the hotel, Intercontinental, looked right out over that Judean Valley. And, of course, the lounge looked out the other way over the city of Jerusalem and the Kidron Valley and down on the city of David, which is a little village down at the foot of the Temple Mount. An interesting thing. Distances are so compressed over there that we can't imagine how close everything is. So Bethany was just a short walk from Jerusalem. Not probably an easy walk. It was a little uphill climb. Anyway, it fits so beautifully, the figure or the description in Ezekiel 44 to 48, that it's hardly necessary to debate it, because it's just there. You've got a temple, you've got a sacrificial system instituted, then you've got the water coming down through that valley, trees growing up alongside it. The waters of the Dead Sea are then sweetened so that the fish live in it again. There are no fish in the Dead Sea. Now, the whole coastline of the Dead Sea is about as arid and barren as the Valley of Judea. You have Ezion Geber, which is a little sort of an oasis, and people go there to get the saltwater baths. You know, the crazy people down there and swim in salt for some reason, or try to. You can't swim much, just float there. But all the, that's the great spa. The people of Jerusalem come down there to Ezion Geber and pack that beach in that salt water, like they do over at Salt Lake City, I guess. You know, I never got interested in swimming in that heavy brine. No fish live in it. Nobody fishing along the banks, but the day comes when that water is all turned into fresh water and fish swim in it again. But it's a natural, because that course runs right from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea. There's no hindrance or obstacle or whatever to that water course running into the Dead Sea. Now, what is all of this abomination of desolation? What is all of this destruction? Well, in the first place, in 70 A.D., Titus, Emperor of Rome, came in and did that. He just totally devastated the temple in Jerusalem and the whole city of Jerusalem. The people fled up to Masada. And whether you've got up there, did you ever get to Masada? Yeah. It's an arid, barren mountain in the midst of an arid, barren desert. There's nothing more barren than the Negev in Israel. Anyway, the people all fled to Masada, but that was a precursor. That was sort of an overture, a preliminary to the ultimate thing, which Jesus indicates is yet to come. If Jesus did not indicate that this was yet to come, we would assume that the prophecy had been fulfilled in 70 A.D. But Jesus speaks of it in ways that go much beyond that and give us the further information that they're going to have to flee from this. When this takes place, this temple's destroyed. So first of all, you have to have a temple rebuilt. That's not going to happen in a month or a year. It's going to be several years. I mean, if you can imagine having to settle the issue with the Arabs and then build your temple, you got some work to do. Okay, so there are those that indicate we don't have to really tear the Mosque of Omar down to build the temple, but I don't think the Arabs would let us get away with it. So I'm building a temple next to their mosque. So that Temple Mount's going to have to be cleared. The Arab problem's going to have to be resolved. And a temple built. And then will come a destruction after that, which will be from the so-called Antichrist. Now, these things I'm talking about are not just speculative. They're very clear in the reading of the passage in Ezekiel and then this passage. And then in the 38th of Ezekiel, which we will come to. But now your sequence of events is this temple is going to have to be built first. And so people wonder why should another temple be built and more sacrifices if Jesus ended the sacrifices? Very simple point. The Jews have to go back to school. They were supposed to fulfill these sacrificial system, and they aborted it. Because God said, I don't want any more sacrifices because they stink. Why? Well, because you're offering them without faith. In other words, they were doing almost, in a certain sense, what they're doing now, observing their traditions without any sense of God. So I've said to you before, their Seder in Jerusalem are not done on the basis of a true worship of God, but a tradition. Young men wear a yarmulke on their head, not because they believe in God's command or orders about it, but because it's a tradition. They want to wear it, proud to be Jews. Young men wear the yarmulkes over there. Our guide in this, the tours that we took wore a yarmulke. Had some interesting conversation with him. Anyway, the Sabbath is very stringently observed. You can't get a loaf of bread or a peanut in Jerusalem from sundown Friday night till sundown Saturday night. And one thing I liked about the Intercontinental Hotel, they didn't observe those amenities. It was a very rigidly observed rule, the Sabbath rule, and yet not for the sake of faith in God. It was just a tradition that they observed, and they're very strong about that. And I think I told you before, but I had a conversation with a woman who had a jewelry shop in the hotel up there, businesswoman, and we discussed that. And she concurred with that point. I think she stayed open on the Sabbath. But anyway, it wasn't a religious thing, but a tradition thing. Now, the point I'm making about that, of course, is that they think, the Jews think, that they are, they got there by their own hand. And that it was their own cleverness that won the battle for them. Now they face a great wall of enemy. The Arab world at the time of the June 1967 invasion, where Egypt invaded, or Egypt actually declared war on Israel, and their response was very strong. But at that point, the Arab nations were not united. They were all just in a collection of little emirates and principalities and sheikdoms and so forth. But meanwhile, from that time to this, there has been a great reorganization of their attitudes and their forces, so that now there are far the Arab nations or countries united together are far superior to Israel at this point. So they're faced with a very formidable enemy if the Arabs decide they're going to join the Muslim hue and cry and take over Palestine. They could theoretically do it now, given their arms. Of course, this is the great focus of things, and I've been saying this for 20 years. The Muslim world is the great threat, and not Russia at all. Russia has a fairly strong military presence, but the economy of Russia basically is pretty shattered. I talked to someone who had just been over in Moscow. I talked to him this week. And they said things are so desolate over there. Buildings that are not being repaired that are crumbling, and consumer products and the stores, everything is just in a state of deterioration. So whereas they might have a military presence, they don't have the economic backup to really press it. And of course, that may be one reason why Gorbachev is now pursuing peace. At a great, with great, greatly assiduous efforts. So, but at any rate, whereas the Christian population and the leaders in the Christian church have all been hammering on the point of the hammer and sickle on Russia, and everybody's been afraid of Russia, and Russia's going to do this and that, and Russia presents at this point very little of a threat as compared to the Muslim world. Russia constitutes a land of 250 million people. The communists, the true communists, who might be marshaled to do something drastic, number about 15 million people out of 250 million. The great move today is back to the religion of the forefathers, which was Christianity. Very important point. I've said this for 50 years, not quite, maybe 20. But I've always said that the strong possibility that Russia would recover its Christianity. Remember, I've talked about that. I said, you know, Christianity came to Russia in 1000 A.D. and was very strong up until the Communist Revolution. Now, the problem that occurred at the time of the Communist Revolution was not the fault of Christianity per se, but of the leadership of the church, who were all siding with the czars. The church represented to the communist forces the aristocracy. It was the same in France at the time of the French Revolution. The clergy were lumped with the nobility because they lived in splendor and were sycophants, as they were yes men to the aristocrats, and that's the way they were at the time of the czars in Russia. And they lived in splendor and had very little vitality of personal faith to offer. So that's why when the communists came in, they executed the religious leaders along with the aristocrats, because they were one and the same. You know, they were part and parcel of the aristocracy. And that's why, of course, Marx saw religion as an opiate of the people. Most of Marx's attitude toward religion was based upon what he saw in the church, the Orthodox Church of Russia. Well, of course, he was wrong on a lot of counts because his observations were limited. For one thing, Marx ignored the whole segment of the middle class. He identified the wealthy landowners as the bourgeoisie and the non-landowners as the proletariat, but there was a large segment of non-property owners that were nevertheless wealthy people. but he ignored them. Now, the bourgeoisie to him were the people with land, and the proletariat were everybody else. And so he ignored the great middle class. But there were numbers of errors in his philosophy. We won't go into that. But the point I'm making to you is that whereas there was a time when the communists seemed to be the international scourge, today communism in the world is in pretty sad case. And but now at the same time you have the rise of the Muslim world. So now the Muslims are 1 billion strong. When I first started talking about this, they were 750 million. Now they're 1 billion. 25% of the population of Russia in the southern region is Muslim. And the Muslims have become part of their city councils and so forth, and you've got a strong Muslim factor in the south of Russia, around the Caucasus Mountains. I've said to you before that the Muslim world is like a crescent, where you begin with the Caucasus Mountains, and you take an arc through Afghanistan and down in the eastern coast of Africa, which is all Muslim. It's what they call a Swahili culture. That is a combination of African and Muslim, a Swahili culture, Swahili language. That's down the eastern coast of Africa. And then you come back up to Morocco at the mouth of the Mediterranean, and you have your population of Muslim. At least 90% in that crescent is Muslim. Many, many of those countries in Africa are 100% Muslim. Many have a small segment that is not Muslim. But anyway, that's the scourge. And here is Israel, a little dot on the landscape, not nearly as big as California, about a third the size of California. And they're surrounded by this great horde or vast number of Muslims. Now you can see the picture coming together, because I've said to you that none of the events that are talked about in the prophetic scriptures, both Old Testament and New Testament, having to do with God's earthly dealings, you know, excluding the church per se, but none of these things are outside the Middle Eastern area. That's the whole arena. The arena of the prophecies included in the Old Testament prophets and in Revelation. All these events are in that arena of the Middle East. They have nothing to do with the United States. I don't know what God can do with the United States. We are totally capable of destroying ourselves, so we don't need any outside help. We may succeed in doing that. We may all just fall off the face of the earth. I don't know. But there's nothing that is said in the New Testament or the Old about the United States. And it seems to me that if God was trying to make a statement about prophecy, that he did not need to wait until the American Revolution to decide there was a United States coming up. In fact, he doesn't mention it. Doesn't mean he didn't know about it. There are very few references that even identify the Western area, if you exclude a bogus Bible that makes a big issue of it, which I won't mention. But anyway, nothing in the Bible that really brings the United States into the picture. I've said to you before, and I'll say it again, as far as destructive factors here, of course, the people who need to fill their coffers by giving leverage warnings like to say the United States is on the verge of disaster, but that's a really faulty notion, because if God destroyed the United States, I've said before, he'd be shooting himself in the foot, because the United States represents the greatest basic bulwark of faith in the world, in spite of its many foibles and follies, and there's certainly segments of evil in the United States. I'm well aware of that, but as always said, at least 50% of your population is very strongly identified with Christ. With Christ, 50%. Up to 75%, at least, maybe 90% are oriented to the idea of God. And they don't always make an issue of it, but I think a poll showed 75% thought it would be a good idea to read a Bible. You know, no commitments, it just asked in a poll, you know, one of the regular mainline polls, you think it's a good idea to read a Bible? And 75% said yes. So that doesn't reflect to me any thing in which God is sitting up in heaven wringing his hands over this terrible prodigal United States. So anyway, it's not mentioned in the Bible. God has his own thing he's going to do with it. So now I should go back and say this much, that no prophecy needs to be fulfilled before Christ comes back. He could come tonight and take the church out. And still, all these events in the East would then start up the time clock, you see. I think the time clock may be on hold for a while until the parenthetical thing called the church runs its course. And then when the church is taken out, then in a certain vernacular sense, all hell breaks loose. But before that does happen, the rather cataclysmic events, you have the following phenomenon, and this is speculative, but it occurs to me that the best way for the Muslims to gain control of Israel is if they could send someone into Jerusalem that had converted from the Jewish faith to the Muslim faith, because he will pretend to be the Messiah, and the people will buy that.